Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show where we talk about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS HD1 and FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, I try to keep my promises. I always try. And this time, I'm happy to say that I'm able to do so, because if you think back just a couple of episodes ago, we went on an absolutely wonderful visit to James Madison's Montpelier, the home of the father of the Constitution. And my only regret in that episode is that I didn't have time to use all of the wonderful tape recordings I'd made with the wonderful people at Montpelier. And now I promised you then that I would come back again. Well, here I am. I'm back. We're back. We're going to Montpelier again. And so we're going to pick up more or less where we left off. We're going to start with John Jeans, who is the fellow who's in charge of the ongoing and extensive renovation of the mansion at Montpelier. After him, we'll talk to Matt Reeves, who is an archaeologist at Montpelier. And then we'll finish up with John again. So today, we're going to go indoors at Montpelier. We're going to go outdoors at Montpelier, they're going to go back indoors again, and all of it, I promise you, is not only relevant to the Constitution, it's not only historical, but it's positively fascinating. Let's join John Jeans as we leave the south end of the Montpelier mansion and head toward the north side of the house.
So we're walking from the south wing into the main block of the house. This is one of the back rooms. This was a heated space that would have housed furnishings and so forth. It would have been likely a sitting room of sorts, perhaps a bedroom at one time or another. But you can see a closed stair here, the original stair rising up to the second floor. This would be the period one stair. We won't go up that just now.
Okay.
We'll step into the front room. And this space is at a little bit higher style. And it is graced with the paneling of the period, which is the 1760s. What you see, the fireplace and the surround, those are the original elements, the hearth as well. And the paneling to the pilasters on the left of the fireplace, reaching over to the edge of the wall, this is all 1760 period material. The fenestration that these large windows sitting in splayed jambs are actually newer.
Hmm.
This is part of Madison's alteration in 1809. He changes all the fenestration. And this is where Dinsmore and Nielsen, Jefferson's master builders, work with Madison to change the symmetry of the house. Now you have these three building periods, these three building campaigns, where they're trying to merge them to give them a more coherent look.
I see, rather than just sort of a series of add-ons.
And so the window sizes, they went from narrow, taller windows to wider.
Mm-hmm.
Windows.
Probably give a lot better views, too.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And also, when we did our investigation, we noted that the center lines of these spaces had been altered in order to give symmetry to the front facade of the building.
Very nice. And that points out something here. You know, with all these building campaigns and all these changes, it's a misnomer to say we want to restore it to Madison's time. The question is, what part of Madison's time? Because he was here for decades.
That's a very good question. And what we elected to do was to restore the house architecturally to that grandest period,
mm-hmm.
Following the third building campaign, that 1809 to 1812 look. And then, as far as furnishings and so forth, then we'll carry through with from that time to post-presidency.
Very good.
One interesting item to note is I stated that these windows were all relatively new, 1809 being
relatively, yeah. Right.
So, but if you look in this small closet here, you see a gorgeous 1760 era window.
Oh, and those are like half the width.
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And that is one of the original windows, and the only original window that Madison chose to keep in the house when he did his renovation in 1809.
Oh, isn't that nice that he did keep one? So now we know what they are like.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good.
And what happened in this space was some of this paneling, you can see it comes up about 4 feet, gorgeous paneling. It had been removed in the Greek Revival period. And unfortunately, in the Greek Revival period, we haven't a clue as to where most of that material went, but we had...
Oh, so we lost a bunch of that, okay.
Well, just in this space, we had perfect evidence, though, for what the paneling was based on what remained by the fireplace and what is original in the South Hall. This is all original material.
Mm-hmm. Now, when was the Greek Revival period? Was that 19th century?
Well, in this house, about late 1840s.
Okay.
They were removing what was called surbase. We call it chair rail today.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all removed from the house at that time. And the paneling in that one room, portions of paneling were removed. And a certain amount of the hardware had been removed and altered at that time as well.
Things like doorknobs, that sort of thing? Or
yeah,
you
we
say
had,
hardware?
We The remnants that we have from the Madison period are these beautiful H&L hinges that you see.
Yes. We're looking at the back door of the main hall, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And the doors themselves.
Mm-hmm.
What we did do was we removed layers of paint from the original doors until we found the paint ghost of the original hardware. And then blacksmiths used templates that were drawn up by Mark Wanger, our architectural historian on site. And then blacksmiths recreated down to the location of the screw holes, nail holes, etc., wherever the fastening material was. And it is quite extraordinary when you have a blacksmith who is conversant in period hardware. They know exactly what each little nail hole might mean. They can very accurately determine what had been in place just by, and you and I would, you know, kind of look the other way and think it would be a piece of useless information, whereas it, for them it would be the Holy Grail. They'd know exactly by just a little mark, oh, okay, this defines it as such and such a piece of hardware or latch.
That's wonderful. We still have artisans around who know such things.
And
a vital link.
They're extraordinarily capable, and it's a niche that is, there are not many people who have those kinds of skills, but it's amazing what they have, the knowledge that they have, and what they can extract. I'll give a perfect example,
sure,
if you don't mind. We can walk over to the jam around this closed stairway, the 1760 stairway. And as you can see, this gorgeous original framework here, you can see a piece of backband, and that's the outside molding that comes right down to meet the wainscot, the cap of the wainscot.
Mm-hmm.
One of our architectural historians had been walking through the cellar. This doorway had been moved into the cellar.
Oh, the whole frame had been moved.
This stair had been removed, and so the frame was reused in the cellar.
Huh.
Myron Stockew was looking at this piece of backband, and he saw where it terminated, and below it he could see the profile of the molding you now see in place, which was...
So he was able to match it.
Well, he was able to look at that in the cellar and say, wait a minute, I recognize the profile of that molding. And he took...
I've seen that molding before.
Yeah. So we come upstairs and we take molding combs, which take the impression of the molding.
Mm-hmm.
And it matched perfectly the ghost, the paint ghost here.
Well, that was a eureka moment, wasn't it?
It was. And what he determined was, at that moment, we had not even begun looking at the stair. He said, this door jamb was on a stairway with a single step land. This is true. And actually, from here down to the bottom.
We're looking at a space about halfway down the door frame where the wainscoting meets this. And yeah, and if that's as much more space as there was on the bottom of the door frame, then that indicates it didn't go all the way down to the hall floor level. There had to be a step.
Exactly. And almost a year before we actually got to this part of the investigation, that information was filed away. And then when we finally got to this area of the house and started doing removals and we could find the lines and so forth, it was confirmed that his prediction was exactly correct.
That must have been a great day. That's just remarkable. And I imagine that it was quite carefully done and quite an undertaking just to remove this frame from downstairs and bring it up. Was most of the stuff that's inside the house in pretty good shape when you got it?
You know, if you're looking at everything on the first floor and above, it was largely in very good shape, all the interior moldings.
Mm-hmm.
When you take a door frame like this and you put it down into a cellar where there are wet conditions, we had to do some work at the bottom to restore the base. But, you know, it was very, that's what all of our craftsmen delight in doing.
Of course.
Another item that we might notice is we're standing in the south hall, which would be the main entry to the original home, the 1760 home. And the paneling that you see is, with the exception of just two leaves to the left of the doorway, all original material, and it had been shuffled into different locations in the house. And it was relocated into this area based on oftentimes simply the nail penetrations that go through the paneling, and where they meet in the masonry walls, there are wooden blocks placed in the masonry walls to receive the nails which affix the paneling.
Right.
And so each one is very discreet. You know, it's a random insertion of a nail at a particular angle, and every one defines very clearly the location of the panel.
Very interesting. Now, I have to notice that it looks as if you have finished the restoration of the actual walls and ceiling and floors, there's not much on them. Now, I realize that's a bit of a different subject, but is there a plan to try to get the... was it originally this Spartan, or were there wall decorations? And if so, is there an effort to find those or to restore them or to put something similar up?
Well, the first phase of the process here, of course, was the architectural restoration of the house. And now we're into the phase of populating the house with Madison elements in their appropriate locations, whether it's draperies, or whether it's paintings, or what have you.
So you have an entirely new project now. Once you get the walls up, you got to figure out what went on the walls.
This is our museum department is working on this and have been for several years now. And they have a database of Madison objects and all the leads that they have to prove the provenance of all of these objects. We haven't done a great deal in this hallway for populating, but we have to start in certain areas. So if we were to step, for example, into the drawing room, you'll see a very different situation where that process is well underway.
Forward to it.
And if you were to step into the dining room, for example, you'd see similarly the process is well underway, or into the new library. And in fact, the next venture is Madison's study. The president's room is slated for wallpaper, draperies, the appropriate bed, and so forth. And in many cases, we have...
Then lead us on. Absolutely. I would love to see some more of this.
Well, Stuart, we are walking into the drawing room. This would be the formal room where Madison would greet his dignitaries and very close friends of the family and so forth. And as you can see, it is quite beautifully appointed.
It is opulent. It is. Well, maybe that's the wrong word, because it doesn't suggest opulent so much as just grand style and very good taste. Could you describe it just sort of generally?
Well, we had mentioned the Venetian doorways from the entry, and that's probably a good place to start. As you walk in from the grand portico,
you see a Venetian doorway with an elliptical fan light above and side lights on either side of double doors. And one interesting feature would be that those side lights are actually pocketing downward. They are hung on weights, counterbalanced.
Really?
And they pocket downward, which is highly unusual.
You mean they open?
They open. And
right, okay. So you could get a breeze.
Exactly. And if you step into the doorway, there's a foyer that you can see. It's about 6 foot width. And then there's the mirror image, that exact same fan light, side lights, doors are mirrored as an entry to the drawing room.
That's a very dramatic effect to have that mirror effect, yeah.
And if you look on the side light to the left of that doorway entering the drawing room, you can see that that window pockets sideways. So as you mentioned, getting that airflow came quite prominently from the portico, and our most of our winds exactly are, you know, from that location. So we have, you know, that was the air conditioning of the time, I suspect.
Yeah, there was no HVAC system in that time, so you had to have some air occasionally. Well, that's very nice, very practical as well.
And if you look to the opposite side of the room to sort of complete that discussion, you have three triple hung windows identical to those at Monticello, and it makes a lot of sense. You have Jefferson and Madison conversing on these architectural elements, and you have the same master builders installing these elements. The profiles on the muntins are identical to those at Monticello, some difference being in that the planes are worn a little bit more by the time they come here. But these sash, the lower two sash, lift up and create doorways in all three. And you see these beautiful louvered blinds on the exterior, the shutters, and they're operable, actually. So if you were trying to control airflow, you could do it to some degree with those and the windows being open.
Okay, so those are installed louvered. Those are not floating or suspended blinds. Those are actually part of the door or the window frame.
They open up
from
the outside.
Okay.
And then the two lower sash rise up. So you have about 6 feet clear space.
So you could walk in or out. Those are those
and,
could
and
be
that's
effectively
exactly,
doors, right?
If they were entertaining, that would be what would be going on there.
Right. Very nice. Okay. And then generally speaking, the primary color in this room, as you all have restored it, is red.
Yes.
It's a beautiful wallpaper.
It's gorgeous. And you know, during the feasibility study, when we were doing all the research on colors, etc., when our paint analyst went over to the head over top of this window here, the trim across the head, she removed a certain amount of paint, and encapsulated in the paint was a fragment of the original wallpaper. And microscopically, she could tell that was a red flocked wallpaper, and it received the very first layer of paint that went onto the trim. So it was quite certain that that was the first covering from that.
And were you able to discern exactly what the pattern was?
That pattern is based on what would be appropriate at the time.
Okay.
Now, there was a certain method of manufacture, and this wallpaper was handmade identically to that method. So this is the kind of thing where they're, 16-inch pieces of paper of a certain width that are each blocked individually and then hooked together. And then there are glue patterns that there is a carved wooden block that has these beautiful ornate flowers and so forth. The glue is put on those blocks and then pressed against the paper, and then when it's removed, there is a coating of red flocking that is dispensed upon.
So that's how that's put on there. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was actually a very sort of dangerous way to of fabrication, because those same little particulate wool fibers also went into people's lungs. People didn't last very long in those days. So when they do that nowadays, they have to have all sorts of ventilation equipment and masks on and things like that in order to do it the way it was in the period.
So among, if we time travel back to the 18th century, paper hanging, not a good profession.
The hanging might not have been so bad, but I think the manufacture
right,
would have
okay.
been brutal.
Okay.
In this particular type of
thing. And that's an important point, because we sometimes forget that life used to be a lot more dangerous and a lot shorter for most people, and in many respects a lot more miserable. And a lot of it was just because of these hazards that maybe people recognized, maybe they didn't, but they weren't in a position to do anything about them.
That is true.
Some things have gotten a lot better.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we're going back to Montpelier, the home of James Madison, the father of our Constitution. We've been indoors with John Jeans. After the break, we'll come back and we'll go out and dig up some stuff with Matt Reeves, the director of archaeology. Stay tuned.
As good as new, my love for you, and keeping it that way is my intention. As good as new, and growing too. Yes, I think it's taking on a new dimension.
I'm Stuart Harris, and we're going back to Montpelier, and we're going to talk to Matthew Reeves, the director of archaeology. Now, you may think it's strange to have an archaeologist at the home of a Virginia planter and one of our former presidents, but it makes a great deal of sense because there's lots of stuff to dig up at Montpelier. And what's really fascinating about Montpelier is the way that much of what's being dug up matches up with our constitutional history. And nowhere is this more apparent than with the history of slavery, which is one of the main issues in our constitutional history. Matt is going to tell us about digging up the foundations, the remains of the home of George Gilmore and his family. George Gilmore was one of the Gilmores were one of the slave families there, whose lives are just now being rediscovered at Montpelier.
You know, the system that Madison and Jefferson structure for state versus federal decision-making, you know, has this long impact through history, and you can see it in the archaeology in these people's lives. And so with George Gilmore, he really, the Gilmore family doesn't enjoy full citizenship. And it's not, it's probably his third and fourth generation family members that finally, after the civil rights legislation, are able to enjoy that. And one thing that we've got here, as well as Montpelier, that completes this story is the train station.
The 1910 train station?
Yeah, the 1911 train station.
1911. See, I'm getting all my dates messed up. I
one can't year is not bad. Right. It's better than the Madison dates.
I'm glad you're here to correct me. But let me just pause and say this is just a remarkable thing, that this whole stretch of constitutional history is physically embodied on this acreage.
And in the physical, literally, it's physically embodied, because with the train station, what we've got is a building that was built by William Dupont, arranged to have it built based on Southern Railway station plans. Mm-hmm. And these plans, what they specify under state law, is that it's to be a segregated space. He doesn't have a choice to make it and have one waiting room for both white and black.
So no matter what DuPont wanted to do when he built his station, he had to specify segregation.
Yeah, state law required that. Mm-hmm. And it's not until the civil rights legislation that that decision is no longer made at the state level, but it's made at the federal level. So, you can start to tell constitutional history here in the legacy of Madison in a very personal way that becomes very relevant for folks that want to come here, want to learn about history, want to learn about people's lives. And so, this whole story about Madison becomes a foil by which people can begin to understand in a very, very, very applied way, how state versus federal powers are changed through time, how they're played out for citizenship. And all of a sudden, what I see, the real power of the African-American story here, combined with Madison being the home of, James Madison, father of the Constitution, is we can make this story interesting. And all of a sudden, people can walk away with these stories that really have bearing on who we are today, what the Constitution means to us today, and how it's changed through time. And you'd never be able to capture just by doing a straight constitutional lecture, because we all had that in civics class in
right.
eighth grade.
And we all started falling asleep.
Yeah, exactly.
This really brings it to life. And in fact, I'll even extend it a little bit and just ask a question. First of all, we're talking about the famous DuPont family from Delaware, right? We're talking
yeah.
about
mm-hmm.
the very wealthy and very prominent family in Delaware. And they represent an important part of American history. They represent
yeah.
the Gilded Age, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
That's when
mm-hmm.
many of these great fortunes were built in the late 19th century. And there were constitutional aspects to that. I mean, during that period of time, the federal courts, especially the Supreme Court, were very friendly toward big business,
mm.
very unfriendly toward labor.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a time when the people, I'm not disparaging the DuPonts, but I'm saying people of that level of wealth pretty much controlled this country.
Yeah.
And so all the opulence of their outbuildings and their riding stables and all, you know, where the center for the Constitution is, the building
mm-hmm.
we're sitting
mm-hmm.
in, all of that opulence and that opulence that allowed this estate to be preserved also
Absolutely.
Has a very significant constitutional aspect. And that's interesting as well. I'm just curious now. Do you have a need or do you have an interest in digging up things that might be from the 20th century as well, from the DuPont era?
That's something that whenever we excavate a site, we begin at the ground surface. And whatever is below the ground surface, we excavate stratigraphically. We save all the artifacts. And
so, layer by layer.
Layer by layer.
Right.
So when we were doing the work on the mansion restoration, we had to do a lot of what's called mitigation archaeology. It means we have to go in there and excavate the area using archaeological techniques before the backhoe gets there. And what the
that would be a mess, wouldn't it?
And we had a lot of ground to move through. That
right.
We excavated all the area of the basement, of the cellars of the mansion. We excavated a huge area, 60 feet by 30 feet in the rear lawn where there was going to be an underground bunker installed. We looked at the front lawn to figure out what the Madison era front landscape looked like. So anytime we came across any layers dating to the DuPont era, we recorded that. And the same with the history of the mansion. We photographed and documented all the architectural elements that we removed from the mansion. So what my job is as an archaeologist here is to make sure that all aspects of all the archaeological deposits are preserved for future generations, and they're not impacted. We're not necessarily focused on the 20th century in the research archaeology we're doing right here, but if we come across those layers, we are preserving them. We're saving them, and I know
right.
that's kind of a roundabout way to answer the question.
That answers it exactly for me. So you're preserving everything, you're documenting everything, but you have to, of course, decide what you're going to focus on research-wise now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we focus on Madison. And now there's this increased focus on the slave era and
mm-hmm.
the archaeology that you were talking about post-Madison as well. I imagine that once, decades from now, when people have felt that they've finished the primary study of that,
mm-hmm.
maybe some future archaeologist, maybe your successor, will decide, we really want to think about the 20th century as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are archaeologists today that are interested in the Gilded Age.
Mm-hmm.
There's a publication that just came out with the Journal for Historical Archaeology it's entitled Archaeology of Poverty,
mm-hmm.
and is looking at just what you're talking about, the contrast between the elite who, epitomized this Gilded Age material culture, but then what everybody else was doing. What was it like to be impoverished in the early 20th century?
There was a huge disparity.
It wasn't the good
wealth.
Old days. So unless you were part of that gilded set.
If your name
you
was DuPont,
white.
If your name was Rockefeller, if your name was, some others that are recognizable, then it was a pretty darn good time.
Yeah, it was the grand old days.
But I don't know about your family, but mine, I don't think, was enjoying that level of wealth.
No, at my various stages, depression had a lot to do with it, but it was like a 10-year period where my grandfather was doing very well, but
uh-huh.
bracketed on either side of that. He was, either working at a Goodyear tire plant or, trying to make ends meet during the depression. So
we're just folks, but it's nice occasionally, it's interesting to think of that level of opulence, and
mm-hmm.
and that's what you have to have. I mean, you have to have that level of money to own literally thousands of acres of this beautiful rolling farmland and woodland,
mm-hmm.
and to be able to have the riding stables and to have all of this other good stuff. And what people don't recognize is that there was a direct constitutional correlation with that. One of the things that enabled people to amass such enormous wealth was the
mm-hmm.
way the Supreme Court was interpreting the Constitution during that era. So that's relevant as well. So this is just a constitutional microcosm here at Montpelier.
Oh, absolutely.
It stretches all the way back to the beginning to the present day, and everything, mm-hmm. almost everything about it is relevant to constitutional history. So I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, no, I am too. I've been working here for 11 years, and uh-huh. still I'm just thrilled that, you know, we keep on making discoveries here. And to have the material representation of the past, architectural items, archaeological items, objects that we, you know, are given for the mansion, that were part of the Madison's household furnishings, all of it, interpreting it in light of the Constitution and in light of Madison's legacy, I think it's so important because it makes it not only relevant for talking about Madison and his role with being a founding father, but also makes it relevant for putting that history into context. That, you know, if we're looking at the furnishings of the Madisons, there's no way just to look at those alone and show what a grand house he had. I mean, they did have a grand house. It was commented upon that the Madisons, you know, had the latest styles in terms of fashion, what they were serving on the table, what they served it on, the plates that we're finding in the archaeological record. But there was context for that that allowed that to happen, which was slavery. And like you're talking about with the DuPonts, I mean, this pattern of, you know, inequity continues through time, and it changes, but it has a structure that not only is there a labor structure, there's a pecking order in terms of the social hierarchy, but there's also a legal and a political structure that allows it to take place. And while it changes through time, we go from slave labor to wage labor. Mm-hmm. And some people might say there's not much difference, but there really is. You know, economically, there might not be. Mm-hmm. But to be able to say, you know, I no longer like this job, I'm going to leave it. I know I'm going to have to make sacrifices. I'm not going to have anything. I'm not going to have any mm-hmm. money, but I'm going to move out west. That's a decision you can make as a wage laborer.
Oh, yeah, it's a huge distinction, but on the other hand,
as a slave, you can't do that.
Oh, no,
no,
of course.
You're being hunted by hounds, by dogs. I mean, sure. You can, if you run away as a wage laborer, you might escape your debts, and they might pursue you in the late 19th, early 20th century, but without the internet, it was more difficult. You could go in hiding.
Right.
But in the 20th century, whether you had a black face or a white face or colors in between, you were seen as a free person. You might not enjoy citizenship, but under slavery, if you were anything other than white, you had to justify why you were where you were and not
at any given time.
At any given time.
And well, that's another fascinating topic, and we're going to have to talk. In fact, Matt, I just know that we're going to have to talk more in the future, and I know I'm going to come back, and maybe we can get more into specific projects or specific sites, or maybe go over and look at your really cool lab next door, which I stumbled upon on my way here. But right now, I've got to run, but thank you so much for your time.
And oh, wonderful talking with you. And hopefully, when you come back, it'll be warmer. And if it's warmer, we'll be out in the field, and you can see what we're finding at the archaeology
site. I'll come back during digging season.
Yeah, during digging season.
All right. Thanks,
Matt.
So
much.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
Wasn't that a great interview with Matthew Reeves? He's such a nice fellow, and I just can't wait to get back to Montpelier during digging season and go out and get my boots muddy with him. But maybe now we should go back indoors, where things are a little bit more genteel, where we can talk more with John Jeans, who's in charge of the renovation of the mansion at Montpelier.
It would be important to say that there's an inventory that was part of Dolly's possession when she sold the house in 1844, and it actually has been determined that it is in a clockwise fashion around the room that various paintings were hung, and there are descriptions of those paintings. Many of them hang in the White House and other localities where many of them we know where they are, some we are still researching. But what we did do was we took the plaster that was on the walls. It was only in this room that you have original Madison plaster. Most of the plaster everywhere else in the house had been replaced.
Mm-hmm.
But this was that original lime-based plaster, and it was part of the very first plastering of this room after 1809. And in the plaster, if you make a penetration in which to hang a picture on a piece of hardware, if you happen to change that out, eventually you'll patch the hole with a certain kind of plaster, and a new hanging would go up, and so forth. Well, our research team, our architectural research team, documented every nail hole in the room and also analyzed the patching material, and were able to figure out what was the first group of paintings or attachments that were on the wall, second, third, fourth.
They were actually able to date them based upon the plaster patches?
That's correct.
Wow.
And then that was all put on a computer-aided design, a CAD drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the known pictures that, for example, the Gilbert Stuarts that may hang at the White House, our team was allowed to go and work with the White House staff to determine what the hanging points were on those original frames.
Good grief.
And from that, each painting that you see is currently located.
That is just remarkable, and I'll just say for our audience that we're looking at several pictures, and I recognize several right off the bat, one of Jefferson, one of Madison himself, one of Dolly, one of a very attractive woman with no shirt on. I don't recognize her, but the
Mary
point...
Mary Magdalene.
Mary Magdalene, okay, very good. I don't mean to be sacrilegious here, but at any rate, those are the four in one small section, and all of that work went in simply to figuring out which paintings were hanging, where they were hanging, at what point on the wall they were hanging, even what their hanging points were. Where
that's correct.
My goodness gracious. And that's a real combination of using high tech, the computer-aided design you mentioned, to go back in time. In fact, as we came in this morning, you're carrying around an iPad today, and you mentioned you have a computer-aided design program on there. And that's just an interesting juxtaposition of the 21st and 18th centuries here working together.
I think Madison and Jefferson would have very much liked to have
I think especially, they would have very much. I think they would have enjoyed those toys. Now, there are several other pictures, of course, a very famous picture of Washington and another very famous one of Jefferson and several others as well. Now, and I noticed there's statuary all around here. Could you describe that a little bit?
Yes. We know that this space, as well as the hallway and the adjacent space, were packed full of statuary. And so these are attempts with Franklin and Jefferson and so forth to bring these busts back in and to position them much where they might have been in the period.
I see one of Madison, Jefferson, Franklin. I'm going to guess. I'm just guessing here. Is that Voltaire?
This one, I'll have to defer to our museum staff.
That's fine. Some extra guy there. Looks kind of French to me. And then toward the front of that, is that Lafayette?
Lafayette.
Right. And then Washington, of course. Yeah. And these are all busts, and they look like big marble busts on pedestals and big pillars, really, is what they look like. And it's a very impressive effect, the white busts against the red background.
There are items that I might mention about this space as far as authenticity. The woodwork in this space, all the cornice is original material. That's Dinsmore and Nielsen, the work that they did for Mr. Madison. The Venetian doorways, both the exterior and the interior, all of the baseboard. The one item that we had to restore would be the surbase or chair rail, which I'd mentioned had been removed in the Greek Revival period. An interesting point is, there was a discussion in the building accounts of the decorative elements on this, the patens, the little floral rosettes that you see inserted. But the profile of this was taken off of the original door jamb off of the back band when the paint was removed a layer at a time until it revealed the very first painting. So that profile is exactly right on.
Right.
And it's wonderful to think that even though these were taken out in the Greek Revival period, that you can, with appropriate skill, determine what had been there. And there are 22 spaces that have different surbase profiles throughout the house.
Right, and this is the chair rail that goes on about 2 or 3 feet above the floor level all around this main drawing room here. So the cross-section, or the profile, as you call it, we know is accurate, but what about the decoration? Was that more informed?
Well, the rosettes, mm-hmm. There was a certain number that were ordered for this room,
and then the decorative elements, the flutes that you see between, would be the appropriate layout in order to make that number of rosettes work. And it happens to be a copy of a mantle, an original Madison mantle in the best chamber upstairs. So it's following that same motif.
So this is very informed and educated speculation. We're not entirely certain, but it's probably a pretty good probability you're pretty close to what it looked like.
Right. You know the you know that the profile is totally accurate. You know that the number of rosettes and their placement is based on the building accounts.
Right.
And the flutes and the use of the rosette are accommodated on a mantle upstairs.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, where we're going back for our second visit, or actually a continuation of our first visit to Montpelier. You know, I've been to a number of historic homes in the United States. I've been to Mount Vernon. I've been to Monticello. I've even been to Alexander Hamilton's often overlooked home in New York City, the Grange. But of all of them, the one that I find the most fascinating is Montpelier, because it's there that you can actually see the ongoing reconstruction of what things were like in Madison's era. After the break, we'll come back and talk some more to John Jeans, who's in charge of the whole thing.
Digging up the past, boys, they're digging up the past. Someone left the door unlocked, so now they're in at last. And what we've yet to do can't touch us. What we've done, it surely can. So don't walk through the working site, they're digging up the past.
It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking to John Jeans, who's in charge of the whole renovation of the mansion at James Madison's Montpelier. And when you're there, I must say that you feel almost as if you could turn around and find yourself looking at Dolly or James Madison.
Kind of fun if we could just get James or Dolly back for a day. Well, and they could make any little tiny corrections that needed to be made.
It's interesting that you say that, because throughout the restoration, the idea was always to try and recreate a home, to restore a home so that it would be recognized by James and Dolly. If they were to walk into the house, would they recognize it? And we went to great lengths. For example, there is a beam below the next wall that you'd said, what kind of shape were certain things in? Well, we did have very serious structural problems where beams and joist tied into the masonry on the first floor, and a lot of that had to be remediated. And there was a rather large beam here, about 36 feet long. It's about 15 inches high, 9 inches wide, and it seemed, for all intent and purpose, to be as solid as the day was long. But we did what's known as resistance drilling. We had a specialist come in and test the timbers by taking a very fine wire and measuring the amount of resistance that it requires to drive that wire through the beam, right through the center. And it turned out the new nickname for that beam became the canoe beam, because on the inside it was just powder.
And really?
The outside 2 inches were very solid. So,
but it had rotted inside.
It was white oak, and white oak seems to have a tendency, when moisture is available, to rot from the inside out.
Wow.
Under these conditions.
That's dangerous. Yeah, you don't know until it breaks.
So what we did was we supported the wall, and we lowered the beam and disengaged all the studs, which mortise into, which tenon into mortises in the beam. We swung the wall out, and then we trenched the beam out and dropped in structural material that would very soundly hold that wall. Yet the outside of that, if Madison, if either James or Dolly were to walk in and put their hand on that beam, as they must have as they passed through the cellar, they would recognize it.
Same thing, yeah. Very good. Yeah, that is the standard, isn't it? If James and Dolly would walk in and feel immediately at home, and of course, it's a standard we'll never be able to completely measure, but we can hope to be close, right?
We can shoot for doing the very best that technology and good judgment will allow.
Great. All right, what's next?
Well, I might mention one other item which I think is of particular interest. We're looking at a fireplace here with a stone surround, which has been painted to match the woodwork.
That's stone.
It's stone.
That looks exactly like the adjacent woodwork. I would not have guessed it.
And that's a carved egg and dart, and it's in St. B's sandstone. And actually, the color is of the hearth that you see below.
That's what that would look like, the hearth color.
That's the same material.
That's an amazing paint job.
So what ended up happening here is eventually, in the 1880s, this egg and dart projection, along with the mantle above, the wooden mantle above, was removed, and the egg and dart roughly chopped away in order to put a more modern Cordovan mantle, a Cordovan marble mantle there. And that hearth that you see had been removed, mm-hmm. and a thinner hearth of about an inch thickness was put in place. You can imagine if this particular hearth that you see is about 2 3/4 inches thick, and you were to remove it and put a 1 inch thick hearth in, you have to fill that with something.
Sure.
So a more modern mortar was put in, and then that hearth was set. Well, when we removed the Cordovan mantle, we found behind it the chopped away egg and dart. We found the plinths that you see. You could still determine what the profile of the plinth was, mm-hmm. and you could see how much it had projected from the evidence on the base. And also, archaeology had cleared in the cellar an area in the southeast portion of the house, and they had located that hearth.
So that just showed up elsewhere, and you thought, okay, now we know where this goes.
It was reused as the base for a root cellar. And the reason we know that this is the appropriate one is when we removed the newer mortar and we traced the high points and the low points on acetate, it transferred perfectly to the backside of that.
Very nice, very nice.
The other additional bonus was the Cordovan mantle had a smaller firebox within, and so a newer brick firebox was built inside. When we removed it, the original Madison firebox is there, and so the charred remnants that you see on the mm-hmm. plaster and so forth were largely accumulated under the view of James and Dolly.
So that's what it looked like. In fact, that was their original, the interior of their original fireplace.
And what our specialists decided the very best thing to do here was simply to stabilize that, not to try and augment it in any way.
Mm-hmm.
You can see on the edges where it's been stabilized so that our visitors would see exactly what James and Dolly saw.
Very good. Very authentic. Very nice. Okay, I'm following you.
Here, right through this door. And in this entryway, sir, we will lead you in us.
So we're walking to the north side of the house, and if you'll note immediately, we've stepped into that 30-foot addition to the north. And what do you note on the walls?
I note a different color, very different color. And plaster, and am I supposed to notice something else?
You know exactly what you've mentioned.
Okay.
This distemper color on the plaster, everything in the other spaces, with the exception of the drawing room, which was changed in 1809, has the white.
Right.
Lamash.
This looks very different. It's a darker, it's not unpleasant, it's more sort of a peach color, isn't it?
Exactly.
Apricot color. Okay.
Yeah. And so this was Dolly's choice as she and James decorated their part of the duplex, we'll call it.
Okay, so this was their end of the house.
Yeah, and if you look towards the portico, there are the flanking doors that they would step out of in order to enter the main block. We have to sort of move back and forth in time to understand this a little bit. This is the addition that was put on in 1797. At that time, there was no communication from within.
Right.
This communication and that doorway and so forth and the Venetian doorway were created in 1809, 1812 building campaigns.
Let me just explain it in lay terms for my own benefit, and you correct me if I'm wrong. If you look at the front of Montpelier, it looks like there are three separate front entrances. Okay.
Exactly.
And that's because they were three separate entrances into three parts of the house, and you had to go out on the front porch and walk from one to the other if you wanted to go between them. And it was only when Jefferson, in conjunction with Madison, decided to make the house more symmetrical and one integrated unit, that this front area was created with all of these arches joining everything.
That's correct.
I got it right. Pleased. Okay, tremendous. And it's much more effective this way. It's much nicer and much more spacious, it seems. Okay.
So there's a gorgeous stair. This is the period two stair that leads up to bedrooms and so forth up above. But what we'll do is step off at the base of the stair to the left, and this is the dining room. And mm-hmm. this is appointed as a part of our study and ongoing research as much, you know, as it was.
John, this is just too cool, and I have to describe this. You walk into this place, and we'll talk about the actual room in a moment, but what first catches your eye is a dining room table around which sit, let me see, eight figures. Yep. And they are what look like, I would describe them as cardboard cutouts, and of people sitting at dinner, and I seem to hear a soundtrack in the back room, right, or background.
Yes, this is to give the sound of the silverware clanking and the discussion going on,
right,
to give a sense of that ambiance that might have accompanied everyone seated at the table.
Tremendous, and I recognize Madison himself in an elderly phase, and I recognize his good friend Thomas Jefferson sitting almost across from him, and several other people of that period as well.
Dolly at the head of the table.
Dolly at the head, yeah.
Lafayette.
Right.
And
several other ladies and gentlemen.
Mary Cutts and Dolly's niece and Andrew Jackson.
Right. And not to ignore the slavery issue, a slave waiting on them on the table as well. Very, very interesting. Okay, but the room itself, of course, is... Now, we're in a part of the house where, as you said, the restoration of the furniture and the other accoutrements is well underway. Now, this looks very finished. So what's happened here?
Well, as you can see, a wallpaper was selected to match that of the period. We know that the room was papered. We were not as fortunate to have as direct a sample as we did in the drawing room.
Mm-hmm.
There is an interesting aside to this, however.
Mm-hmm.
In one of the rooms directly above us, in the wall right over our head, that wall, the studs open up into the attic, and there's a space leading from the attic in between the stud wall. And if you can imagine that when the house was first plastered, you had the lath that runs horizontally, and then the plaster is smeared into it, and it keys back into between the gaps in the lath,
mm-hmm.
and little bits of plaster drop down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it actually turns out to be a fair amount of plaster, and with each subsequent plastering, as cracks and things like that form and alterations are made to try and clean that up. Maybe the plaster is removed, it's replastered. You end up having these stratified layers within the wall that are time capsules. So,
oh, of course, it's almost like stalactites and stalagmites in a cave.
Sure.
Okay.
And so what you end up having in this wall upstairs, there were four different layers, each in its own time-specific stratified layer.
Huh.
And so what you find on the very... And actually, I was fortunate enough to be participating in that and removing items from the wall and seeing it firsthand, the baseboard came off. So you were taking the elements that were on the very bottom at first, and they would be the building material, shavings from a plane, a nail that might have dropped in, or original shingles off of the main block that when they tied the two roofs together, dropped down in there. So that was also very informative for how our roof would be rebuilt. But we had the addition of items that were brought to us by rodents, mice. I'd like to say mice.
Right, sure.
Instead of anything larger than that.
One hopes.
But the mice would bring all sorts of things. They would bring pieces of fabric from the period.
Huh.
We have one little section of paper, a handwritten note from Madison.
No way. The mice took a note and put it between the walls.
Well, it was a section. Unfortunately, uh-huh. they may have dined on a portion of it and left us maybe 3 square inches.
And right.
So, but that was in there along with another 300-some samples, oftentimes wallpaper. They were not specific enough to tell us which space
they took the wallpaper from. So, you know, but we have samples of wallpaper that are period wallpaper that we can choose from.
Very good.
To some degree, but we have, you know, they didn't tell us what room it came from, so that's a bit.
Now, this is very different wallpaper. This is a combination of the color we mentioned before, the sort of, what did you call the color?
Well, I was thinking that it was sort of an olive color.
Right, olive, sort of tan, yeah. Olive color, and then a green color, and the wallpaper looks like drapes. Doesn't
yes,
that
it
the
does.
Theme? Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
You'll note in this room, the process has begun hanging another map of the period
right.
that was known to be in here. This is the Joshua Fry, the Peter Jefferson map.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing, it's resting on the wall, which has a rather brown finish.
Yeah, it looks sort of almost like marble or stone of some sort.
It's a special way that you would finish the plaster if it were to receive either wallpaper or the distemper paint outside.
Oh, because it's rougher. Ones. It provides more of an adhesion. Is that it?
Well, I think if you consider, typically there'd be three coats. There would be a scratch coat that would go right on the lath or directly on the masonry, depending whether it's an interior frame wall or an exterior or interior masonry wall.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the first coat. The second coat would be a brown coat, which adheres to it, which is not quite as thick as the first coat. And then the third coat would be a white coat, which would be a very thin but fine texture, which would be used on the ceilings.
Right.
That, in fact, is used on that ceiling. However, if you could cut back on the labor and be somewhat more parsimonious and careful, you could get away with only two coats if your second coat was done more smoothly. And that's the case here. This will get a wallpaper, and it's in fact, I believe it has already been made for us and will be installed shortly.
All right.
So that will induce you to come visit us again.
Oh, I'll be back. I will be back. This is an ongoing process. It's very exciting to see it all coming together.
Digging up the past, boys, they're digging up the past. Someone left the door unlocked, so now they're an adolescent. What we've yet to do can't touch us. What we've done, it surely can. So don't walk through the working site. They're digging up the past.
So I guess everyone's agreed that James Madison was a sharp guy. In fact, he was a sharp guy right to the end of his days, which, of course, he spent right there at Montpelier. But once again, the clock is tyrannical, and it won't let me finish my wonderful tour of the house with John Jean, so we're just going to have to save that for another episode. I promise we'll come back. And in fact, it gets rather dramatic, because we're going to go and look at James Madison's library. We're going to go and we're going to see the room where he died. We're going to hear a first-person account from Paul Jennings, who was with him when he passed away, but I don't want to get ahead of myself. That's all for our next episode, our next visit back to James Madison's Montpelier. In the meantime, my executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution. I know James Madison might have thought about it, but it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.
What they do is much the same, because the past lives in the present, and nothing's ever changed. Well, they're digging up the past, boys, they're digging up the past. Someone left the door unlocked, so now they're an adolescent. What we've yet to do can't touch us, but we've done it, surely can. So don't walk through the working site, they're digging up the past.
Hi, this is Stuart Harris. Before we go, let me just remind you that, hey, we're very high-tech here at Your Weekly Constitutional, so just get online sometime and Google us, Your Weekly Constitutional. You'll pull up our Facebook page. You could be a fan. Well, you'll pull up our Twitter page if you want to. And, of course, you can always get us on iTunes, and you can listen to any of our episodes, all of which are posted as podcasts within a week or so after their first broadcast here at WETS. So get online and get clicking.
Come to the same conclusion. The past is always sad.